This is Dr. Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, initiating an oral history interview with Helen Hagelheimer. Today's date is the 15th of June, 2004. I am in the interview room in the Special Collections Building on the campus of Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas, and Helen is speaking to me by telephone from California. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning.
We've already been speaking a little bit, but I wonder if, just by way of starting for the interview, you could tell me where you were born and when.
Oh, I was born in Fontana, California,
mm-hmm.
in 1944.
Okay. Go ahead, Helen.
In September, and I was born, I might add, on the grounds of the Kaiser Steel Mill.
And how did that come about?
My father worked at the mill during the war.
Okay. And did they then have a clinic for family members? Or
they actually had a hospital on the grounds.
Okay.
It's the first Kaiser hospital.
And that would be the origins of the Kaiser Permanente group?
Yes, yes.
That's really
that my father worked for up until his retirement, actually.
And what did your father do during the war at the plant?
Personnel and labor relations, as I understand it.
Did he ever tell you much about what happened during the war that he was involved with, like any labor disputes, or was there...
No, there were none.
Uh-huh.
He was adamant against union organization.
Okay.
Because he spent most of his career negotiating on the management side.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, he respected good union organization, that's for sure. But, no, there wasn't any. There wasn't any. My mother still has. My father is no longer alive.
Mm-hmm.
My mother still has a paycheck of his, which is really interesting because it has victory taxes on it.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
And your mother is still with us?
Yes, yes.
And what about her during the war? Did she have employment outside the home?
No, she took care of the kids.
And how many kids are we talking about?
I'm the youngest of three girls.
And your older sisters are separated from you in age by how much?
6 years. My oldest sister is 6 years older than I am, and my middle sister is only two years older.
Okay.
So we're essentially the same age.
And all California natives? Your sisters
mm-hmm.
were born there as well?
No. My middle sister was born in San Diego. That's when my parents first came out.
Okay.
My older sister was born in Indiana, where my parents originate from. They came out. They came out because it was employment in California during the war. They worked my father worked in the plants, worked for Convair in San Diego.
Okay.
First.
And so he had come out specifically during the war for
jobs.
For defense industry stuff.
Yes, because, mm-hmm. you know, they'd gone through the Depression and there were, they said placards all over in Indiana saying go to California because there's jobs there. And they did.
And did they pick up together and leave together, your parents, or did your dad come out first?
My father came out first, and then the rest of the family followed. And he had several brothers. My father was from both my parents are from large families.
Okay, uh-huh.
But my father had eight brothers and sisters, and nearly all of them came out, and nearly all of them worked in the steel mill.
And did they stay after the war, like your folks apparently did?
Yes.
They did?
Yes,
uh-huh.
yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a great deal of my family lived in Fontana for years until my generation eventually moved out, and my father's generation passed on, really.
What kind of a town was Fontana when you were growing up
there? Armpit of the world. It is still the armpit of the world.
Some people say that about Lubbock.
It is, you know, it's in that, it's in the Los Angeles basin.
Yes.
And uh-huh. it is right on the edge of the desert. And it's dry and has lines of eucalyptus trees and gets hit very hard by the Santa Ana winds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hot and it's dirty and it's just not a nice place. It's a steel mill town only on the West Coast.
And did your dad work in steel mills back in Indiana?
I don't know. I know that he was in the CCC during that time.
Uh-huh.
I think he did anything that he could.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
You know.
Yeah, you pretty much had to during
yeah.
the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
He
left school at the 10th grade. He didn't get his high school diploma until he was 60, 62, I think.
What made him go back and do it?
Pride.
Was that pushed by your mom at all, or just
no.
was it?
No, my
his...
parents were divorced at that time.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
My mother has a high school diploma, though.
And so it was just his own wanting to have that accomplishment?
Yeah, when he wanted to do it, he checked with his high school back in Indiana, and mm-hmm. they gave him life experience and said the only thing he really had to take was government. And so he took a government history class mm-hmm. in night school.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, had a young teacher, and my dad did most of the lecturing because my father had lived through most of the history they had to learn, you know, about the labor movement and the Depression and
things like
that. And so he turned out, which suited my father quite well.
Why do you say that?
Well, my father was very arrogant.
Oh, okay.
but that arrogance served him well through life.
What was the Kaiser plant making while he was there? Do you know?
It's a steel mill. It was just making steel for the war.
Okay, uh-huh. Sheet steel, that kind of thing?
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah.
And did he continue working in the personnel and labor administration area?
We moved back to Michigan, and he worked for Kaiser Autos.
Okay, and that would be in Detroit?
Ypsilanti and Lansing.
Okay.
You know, those places when mm-hmm. those were really lovely towns. And then we moved to Atlanta, Georgia, St. Louis, and then back to California, where he went into after the Kaiser cars were finished,
mm-hmm.
you know, when
mm-hmm.
they shut those down. And he worked for Kaiser Aerospace. It was Kaiser Aircraft in those days. And he was in labor relations.
And did you spend any time in Michigan growing up?
Uh-huh. I went to kindergarten in Michigan. I have
in Ipsy or
I think it was actually Lansing.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure. I'd have to check with my mother. It was either Ypsilanti or Lansing.
Okay. Any memories of living up there?
It was cold.
Yes.
We were very close to the college, to the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's about all I remember is, you know, bits and pieces like that. I remember it being cold. And then we moved from there to Atlanta,
yeah,
right, and where my mother refused to tell us about. This was late 40s,
mm-hmm.
maybe 49 or 50. My mother refused to explain to us what the colored signs were and why we had to sit in the front of the bus when the back of the bus was empty, or stand in the front of the bus. She would not tell us. She would not explain that to us, and since I was the youngest, and my two older sisters were usually in school, I got her into a lot of trouble because I was always going to the wrong,
mm-hmm.
Walking into the wrong bathroom or the wrong, you know, using the wrong fountain, and always wondering why we couldn't sit down in the bus. She refused to get what was then known as a mammy, a maid.
Mm-hmm.
So the black community didn't like her, and they certainly didn't call it the black community because they felt like if she's out there hanging her own clothes in this sort of, you know, condo, what would now be referred to as a condo community that we lived in,
mm-hmm.
that if she was hanging her own clothes, then she was taking away the job of a black maid. But my mother refused to have a maid. Now, oddly enough, you have to remember the times. This is the late 40s.
Absolutely.
Very late 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Our neighbors were Jewish immigrants from Europe, having survived the war.
Really?
And their little girl had been born just after the war, probably in one of the relocation camps.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the northern white family and the Jewish family, right? And we were obvious outcasts.
Yeah.
In the Atlanta, Georgia of 1949 or 50, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so we kept really close together, and I still remember that little girl when we moved away because I felt like we were abandoning her. She was about my age. And you know, they no more understood the rules and regulations of the South in those days than we did, quite frankly. So we were both very, very much outcast.
That's interesting, Helen. Do you have any notion of where in Europe they were from?
No, I don't. You know, things like that were not spoken about in those days. I wish I did. You know, because I certainly have never forgotten that family. My mother wouldn't even mention the fact that they were Jewish, because then that would imply that there was something different with them.
Now, she wouldn't mention this to you kids?
No, she wouldn't. We just knew that they were from Europe.
Okay.
Because they had an accent, you know. But later my mother, of course, explains to us that they were Jewish, and that was why they too were so odd.
And did you go ahead, Helen?
In that community. So it was a very interesting Southern experience for me.
How long were you there?
Not very long, but I'll tell you what, I remember nearly all of it. I didn't like it, because my mother would not explain why these rules were, mm-hmm. you know, and I was certainly old enough to have understood, well, that's for other people or something like that, but mm-hmm. She refused to teach us anything that had to do with prejudice. And she would not explain any of it to us.
Was this, you knowing her now and all of this retrospectively thinking about it, was she trying to prevent you from picking up these coded signals and therefore keep you from absorbing some kind of prejudice view as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. That was what she was doing.
And do you know whether she had any experiences with African Americans up in Indiana?
She lived in Gary, Indiana, the melting pot of the world.
So she absolutely had experience.
And she loved it. You know, she said it was very different then, because everybody was first generation. She wasn't. Her family came from England, and I think she was third generation.
Mm-hmm.
But she said in Gary, you walked around the neighborhoods just to smell the food. You know, everybody, the Polish were in one neighborhood, and the Czechs in the other. It was very... that sort of Slovakian, you know.
Sure.
And in Gary, Indiana. And you went to their celebrations, you know, and had fun with them. You enjoyed sort of everybody else's culture, because it was so different from yours.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so her memories of growing up in you know, Gary, Indiana, also Steel Town, by the way.
Absolutely.
You know, was that it was fun to do.
Wow.
You know, that you sort of celebrated everybody's, you know, different, you know, foods and celebrations and things like that. So
when you were in Atlanta, did you have African American friends? What kind of school were you going
to? Oh, absolutely not.
Really?
No.
Okay.
No.
What school did you go to?
I don't remember the name of the school. I'm sure it's... My mother probably would remember it, but it was a very white neighborhood. We were in a suburb of Atlanta.
Whereabouts do you remember?
No, because I really don't know Atlanta that well.
I see. That's fine. Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. But I know that it was away from the city, and it was a newer, in those days,
area. Uh-huh.
You know, a newer area that was popping up. I'm sure. I remember Atlanta as being a relatively small town. Having also lived in, you know, in the Detroit area and St. Louis.
Right.
You know, of course, it's not that way anymore. But,
no.
You know.
But that's great to remember it that way.
Well, and I remember everything was named Peachtree Street.
Well, that's certainly still true.
Yeah. I mean, we stayed, when we first moved there, we stayed in a hotel on Peachtree Street.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
You know, probably it was a Peachtree Manor, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was always fun, staying in hotels. Every time my father was transferred, we would stay in a hotel until we found a house to live in.
And that was fun for you?
It got tiring after a while. Mm. It got tiring after a while. Once we got to California, by the time I was in the second grade, I think I had attended about four different schools. And so that was pretty much enough.
Yeah.
I think it was probably enough for my mother.
Yes,
well.
I'll bet with three kids. And
yeah, there was a joke that every time she put the draperies up, she hung the draperies, my father would come home and say, I'm transferred.
And did he have any choice in these transfers? Or?
No, he was moving around the United States, closing down Kaiser facilities.
Okay.
Kaiser automobile facilities.
Uh-huh. Okay. Uh-huh.
So I suspect, although I've never asked, that they knew that they were going to be doing this transferring. And until they finally came back to Oakland, which, you know, was Kaiser headquarters, and,
right.
and then that's when he ended his career
okay.
in Oakland.
In Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a little bit about him specifically. Can you mm-hmm. just give his name?
Fred and, Wesley.
Okay. And his last name was Tennant, is that right?
Tennant, yeah.
Okay, that's how is that spelled?
Huh? It's T-E-N-N-A-N-T.
And what was your mom's name and her maiden name?
Helen Taylor.
Okay.
I'm named after her. And my middle name is even Taylor.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Now, what about your sister's older name? Or your
oh,
older
my
sisters?
Older, my sisters have beautiful names. I have Helen Taylor. My oldest sister is Catherine Eileen and Lola Michelle.
Are those family names also?
My mom and dad, as a family story goes,
uh-huh.
My father was to name all the girls and my mother was to name all the boys.
Okay.
Yeah, right, so she lost out.
Right.
And my father named us all after one of his sisters. So,
wow, that's nice.
My oldest sister, Kathy, is named after a sister of my father's that died shortly after birth.
Mm-hmm.
That before he was born, mm-hmm. actually, and my middle sister is named Lola mm-hmm. Michelle. Her nickname is Mickey. I still call her Mickey because we have an Aunt Lola that lives up here in the Bay Area and is still alive and is very close to our family because she has no children. And my mother's name is Helen, and I had an Aunt Helen. I had two Aunt Helens, as a matter of fact.
No kidding.
No. And
so that was a pretty safe call then.
It was. And and so I am still I am still known as Baby Helen. And my father called me Junior, and which I hated as an adolescent, but mm-hmm. I absolutely loved as I got older.
Yeah.
He always called me Junior.
It's
yeah.
pretty cool. Yeah. Especially
yeah.
when your dad calls you something
yeah.
special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's kind of nice. Let me ask a little bit about the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
Helen, you and I were speaking earlier about your uncle. Where does he fit in the family tree?
My uncle, Bob, is my father's youngest brother.
So is his last name Tennant as well?
Yeah, yes, it is.
Okay. And Bob served during World War II, but you mentioned that you had another uncle who also served his brother.
Yes, my father is the second eldest in the family.
Uh-huh.
And my Uncle Bob, my Uncle Frank, and my Aunt Helen were the three youngest in the family, and they entered the war in 1943 at the urging, as the story goes, mm-hmm. of their mother, my grandmother, because then she could get their allotment because they were all single.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. So they did. They all entered in 1943. My Uncle Bob, who was the only surviving of that three,
mm-hmm.
was only 17. So she had to sign for him. And fortunately, Uncle Frank and Uncle Bob entered the Army together and served all the way through to VE Day, which I just think is astounding.
They were both then in the 75th Infantry Division?
Yes, the 270, no, it is the 75th Infantry Division, 275th Combat Engineers. I have to get that right or he'd not be happy with me.
Right. Let me ask first about your aunt who was also in the service. Which branch was she in?
She was in the Army.
Okay.
The Women's Army Corps.
Sure.
RAC.
What do you know about her service? Anything?
What I know is mostly from my cousin who is my generation.
Sure.
And a photograph of her standing next to an airplane in this really disgusting dress that was known as their khakis.
Yes, uh-huh.
But actually, she, all three of my aunt and my two uncles are registered on the World War II database on the Internet with photographs.
Okay, good.
You know, that are also, by the way, at the memorial at the kiosk, which was a great delight to my uncle to be able to, you know, punch in Tennant and have their photographs in there.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. He was very happy with that.
Yeah, that's a thrill. It had to be a thrill.
Yeah, that was a real thrill. Mm-hmm. That was the last night that we were in D.C. when we went back for the dedication. And it was sort of as if, okay, it's here forever. So now I can, you know.
And the reference there is to the dedication of the World War II Memorial, which happened here just, what, 2 weeks ago.
Yes, and we were at the kiosk, the information kiosk, mm-hmm. where you can type in someone's name in a computer, and this wonderful photograph comes up that I had entered in several months ago. So it and all the photographs were taken while they were in the military. So they're they're error photographs. They're very good.
Right.
But she was apparently a photographer,
uh-huh.
and as my cousin would say, she learned how to swear in the Army. She loved it, and apparently went up in airplanes and took photographs of the practice bombing runs of, you know, whether they were good or not for the pilots.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Any idea where she was assigned?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
I only know that it was from 1943 until VE Day.
Did she, I don't know whether you know this, Helen, or whether your cousin might have told you, did she identify in later years as, you know, strongly with having served?
No.
During the war?
No, as a matter of fact, I had always known for some unknown reason that both of my uncles had been in the Battle of the Bulge during the World War II,
mm-hmm.
but only knew about my aunt, and actually I was rather close to her because, you know, I'm named after her.
Yes.
I'd only known about her because my mother has this wonderful photograph collection. She seemed to be the family, you know, archivist,
mm-hmm.
and I recall seeing a photograph of her in this dress and asking my mother about it, or it was written on the back that it was her and that she was a photographer in the Army,
huh.
and never asked her when she was alive about it, and I never heard her talk about it, although apparently she certainly did to her daughter.
But she had the sort of expression that came from her when she did talk about it was that she had enjoyed doing this. And
according to my cousin, she really enjoyed it, learned how to swear, and then loved the Army, and that she was the best damn photographer there was in the Army. So clearly she took pride in it.
Absolutely.
You know, I would have loved to have heard the stories.
Yeah.
And I, as I say, I was very close to her and wish I had asked her when she was still alive,
right.
about
right.
it, you know.
Well, you're clearly an oral historian at heart, so I think it's completely apropos that you be interviewed yourself. Let me ask you a little bit about your Uncle Bob and the experience that you had at the dedication. You
mm-hmm.
took him to Washington, D.C., a couple weeks ago during Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, I shamed him into going. He didn't want any part of it.
But, and how did you persuade him, Helen?
I actually kept talking to him for the better part of a year. And finally he seemed to think that he would be going back there and hearing a lot of war stories, and he's very much protected himself. He won't watch war programs, never watch Band of Brothers, won't do any of that, because they're clearly, as was displayed to me when I was in D.C., they're clearly memory triggers, and he doesn't want any part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought that if he went back there, there would be reunions and people would talk about old war stories, you know. And having been around enough Vietnam veterans in my time, I knew that that wasn't really necessarily the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept talking to him about it, and he's a grumpy kind of a guy, a real sweetheart, but, you know,
mm-hmm.
has this sort of, you know, growl to him, and I, for some reason, am not at all afraid of that. You know,
okay.
It's not very
mm-hmm.
effective with me. So I finally said to him, you know, you're going to regret not doing this, and you should do it for your brother and your sister who are no longer with us, and you're healthy, and you can afford it, and you should do it. And then I left it at that, and he called me probably 2 or 3 weeks later and said, well, have you made arrangements yet?
mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Then as we got closer, he was really excited to go.
Is that right?
Very excited to go.
Uh-huh.
And I think this notion of of not, you know, I think that he'd put into perspective that there wasn't going to be a lot of conversation about, you know, battles and, you know, the things he did not want to remember, you know.
The difficult parts.
Yeah. I'm not sure that anybody that has experienced combat really wants to remember them, and I'm suspicious of those that do. So, but, you know, as we got closer to Memorial Day, there was more and more conversation about World War II and things like that and the dedication, you know, coming up on Memorial Day. And he was hearing news stories, and there were going to be a lot of people in town. And he was getting more and more excited about it. So,
You mentioned that you went with him to Union Square, or to the Union Station, I'm sorry, and that there was a display there.
Yes.
Of photographs.
You know, I was trying to get my uncle's daughter and his first wife have both passed away. He has remarried. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just for everybody's knowledge, you can remarry at 75 and be happy.
There you go.
Disgustingly happy, as a matter of fact. They were just too cute for me.
You know, too cute, huh?
Too cute at times. So his wife is dead, and so is his daughter. Mm-hmm. My cousin died a couple of years ago. And I have been curious about his service. And so we went to Union Station because it's just one of my favorite places to have lunch. Mm-hmm. We had just been to the World War II Memorial, our first day there, full day there, and we had visited it. And in Union Station, the AP, Associated Press, had this wonderful display of World War II photographs. And we were looking at it. He got very upset at a battle scene that was in the Pacific, if I'm not mistaken, on Iwo Jima. Mm-hmm. And apparently said to no one, but to everyone that could hear in sort of this bellowing voice, no matter how good the photograph is, it doesn't really show what combat really is like. No one, they can look at these photographs all they want, but no one, you're still not going to know what it's really like. And so I could tell he was obviously upset.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, when no one said anything to him, you know, because the World War II people ruled that town, I'll tell you.
I'll bet
you.
I'll bet.
So I took him over to another photo that was of American troops in Paris on the, obviously liberating Paris, one of those pictures I think all of us have seen. And took him over to that one and asked him if he had been one of those guys, and he said no, but I was in Paris after the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked him innocently enough, what was VE Day like? And he couldn't recall and didn't know. And I said, oh, come on, Uncle Bob, you have to know what that was like. And he couldn't remember anything about it. And
mm-hmm.
I said, well, do you remember that the battles, the war sort of, you know, winding down? And he said, as soon as we crossed the Rhine, the war started to wind down. And he said, I can remember being on the our side of the Rhine and watching an artillery barrage, and then he broke down. And so then we waited for him to recuperate from that. And then he said, once we crossed the Rhine, then things did wind down. But I don't remember VE Day. So I decided that maybe VE Day was a lot more exciting for us over here than it was for him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Since he had the potential of rotating to the Pacific, because that war was still going
sure,
on.
Sure, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But then the rest of the day, I would catch him. And he'd be thinking, and I said, you're still trying to figure it out. And he said, I'm trying to do a timeline, and I can't figure out where I was. Now, my uncle was injured he was on KP duty after the end of the war, at least at a period where he was standing down.
Okay.
And so we don't know if it was actually VE Day or just before. And there was a kerosene stove that they used, and he was actually very very truthful about this. He said, you know, you had to take the kerosene stove out, and if you didn't empty it, it was going to blow up. It was as simple as that, and I forgot to empty it. So it blew up.
Yikes.
So it was entirely his fault. By the way, he received a small amount of money from the military for his burns that he received.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then was taken to a hospital someplace, but he doesn't know where or even in what country.
But these were quite severe
Very severe
injuries.
Burns.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very severe burns. He has very remarkable scarring on his chest. Not his face, though, and parts of his arms. And he was, VE Day was in May of 45. He didn't return home until February of 46. So he was in the hospital for a long time.
Absolutely, wow.
And came across on a hospital ship and then went to a VA hospital in Indiana close to his hometown.
Wow.
But during our stay there, mm-hmm. bits and pieces of his little timeline that he was trying to place together would pop up. But what really got it was running into another guy at the World War II Memorial with a literally a cardboard sign that he had made himself around his neck that said 75, the 75th. It only said 75th. It didn't say ID on it, because I don't think that they used the designator of ID. They called it all out, the 75th Infantry Division.
Yes, I think that's right.
Oh. And I think that's something that's new that the guys call it these days. But I grabbed the man with this thing and said, wait, and yelled at my uncle, who was ahead of me a few steps. And they started to talk. And that was just an amazing thing to be able to witness that.
What was the content and tenor of their talk together?
They were just saying, you know, where were you when, and that kind of thing. They mm-hmm. were apparently the entire 75th ID was in the Battle of the Bulge, so that sort of almost went without saying. They asked each other when they had gotten to the front, and they both had been at the front within days of each other, so they probably traveled even from Fort Leonardwood. Together.
Mm-hmm.
But what a nice gentleman that was, very animated, and he said, I was in the cigarette camps. And I had never heard that expression before, and that really, my uncle really lit up when he heard that expression. Because my uncle lit up, but, you know, you have to really know him to know that he's lighting up. The man said, you remember the cigarette camps? They were named after cigarette brands. And he said, I was at Lucky Strike. Well, that was the camp where my uncle was injured. And that pieced together a huge piece of his timeline that mm-hmm. he kept trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, he knew he was there. He knew he was standing down waiting for VE Day to happen. So apparently they had quite a bit of knowledge ahead of time. And that's where he was injured. And we're guessing he might have been in the hospital when, you know, VE Day actually happened, which was, what, May 6th?
Right, when the champagne corks were popping in Paris, he was probably in a hospital
somewhere. Yes, yeah. And that's why he doesn't remember it, and still didn't. Mm-hmm. As we left D.C., he still did not recall the day itself, but he now understood. But he never remembered, he had not remembered until that man said that, where it was that he was injured. It was just someplace where, you know.
Stored away somewhere.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's quite remarkable. And also, you went over to Arlington.
Yes, we did, because in my travels to D.C., I had discovered a plaque right across the little, I call them lanes. They're not really very large roads, are they, in Arlington?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Right across from the Tomb of the Unknowns and the amphitheater is a plaque dedicated to the men and women of the Battle of the Bulge. And I wanted to make sure that he saw the plaque. And it's a modest plaque.
Mm-hmm.
We had just seen the changing of the guards, and he and my aunt were sitting at a bench, and I said, why don't you guys sit here and let me go find that plaque again so that we can walk directly to it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it didn't take it took me only a second to find it because it was flanked by four very, very good-sized reefs. And so I took them over to it. And the reefs were from Belgium and Luxembourg, and there were four of them, Belgium, Luxembourg, and these were in Holland, Belgium, Luxembourg, and Holland, and then the fourth one was from the Belgium Veterans Association. And he was stunned that after all of these years, these reefs would come from foreign countries. And the writing on the ribbon on the reefs, where I could make out that one was Belgium, one was Luxembourg, and one was Holland, but it was in their native language.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very taken with that. And I have a very nice photograph of him standing, you know, amongst those reefs and that plaque. So it's quite nice.
And it was very moving for him?
He was surprised. You know, if I had to say one word, it was surprised. He completely did not expect people to thank him. And people would walk up to him because I made him buy a World War II hat the first day we were there.
and you probably made him wear it, too.
Well, actually, he wore proudly.
Oh, did he?
He
okay.
did.
Uh-huh.
He really got into it, and I thought I was going to have a real conversation with him, you know.
Right.
But he also got a polo shirt, you know, World War II polo shirt, mm-hmm. and he wore that as well without me having to nudge him.
Okay.
And he was stunned at the people that would walk up to him and thank him. And people didn't just, you know, sort of hesitate in their, wherever they were moving to and say thank you. They'd actually stop and shake his hand and ask him what theater he was in and what years and thank you very much and have these long conversations with him. And around the memorial, one might expect that a bit, right? But when we would go to Alexandria or to dinner any place or to breakfast, it continued. It was all over. And we went to one striking place. My uncle is very is a very religious man. My aunt and uncle are very go to church, and the church is something that's very important in their lives. So I wanted to make sure that they saw the National Cathedral.
Yeah.
And in walking out of the National Cathedral, this man, 40-something, walked up to him. And, of course, my uncle had his World War II hat on and shook his hand, asked him where he was from, where he served, what years was quick enough to know that when he said Belgium and Holland, that meant the Battle of the Bulge, and asked him if he was in the Battle of the Bulge, and shook his hand, and we really appreciate you being here, and we really appreciate your service. I mean, really, really lengthy appreciation. He wasn't used to that, and he was, you know, a private first class and proud of it, and people were saluting him. You know, they would walk by and salute him. And that sort of unnerved him. He said, I don't know why they're doing that. I think he liked them saying thank you better than he did the salutes. And I said, you know, they're saluting your service, not what rank you might have been. And I said, so you have to take it in that spirit. Well, then he kind of liked that. So if I had to say anything, he did not expect after a memorial that was dedicated, in his words, far too late, that he did not expect people to actually thank him for his service. That really, really stunned him.
And these were younger people.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And when I took him over to the wall, the Vietnam Veteran Memorial,
yes.
They were all, you know, nobody knows how to thank another vet better than a Vietnam vet. And they were all over him. They would walk over to his bench and talk to him for a very long time. You know, it was rolling thunder. There were these sort of long-haired kind of guys around. And I think he was he was shocked that this long-haired guy was coming up to even talk to him.
Sure. But they have something in common.
Yes. And actually, my uncle finally quite quickly said, we all had to do something. And so that was his response to everybody thanking him. Well, you know, we all did something, which is pretty true. Even if someone was a civilian during World War II, they did a great deal.
Or in your case, Helen, a civilian during Vietnam era.
Yes.
Yeah.
He was, I could tell that the Vietnam vets that came up to him were very pleased that a World War II was acknowledging their service as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
Did you have any conversations while you were there and at the wall? Did anybody come up to you and say, Helen, what did you do during the Vietnam era? And you said, well, I was.
Well, actually, you know, a Vietnam friend of mine passed away of cancer, and I won't be convinced that it wasn't Agent Orange related.
I see.
A couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. And so I had taken some white carnations on Memorial Day. My aunt and uncle left on Memorial Day, and so I was at the wall for the services on Memorial Day by myself.
I see. Mm-hmm.
And they have the new in memory plaque.
Yes.
And I thought that I should probably put some of my bouquet of flowers for my friend at that plaque. And some went to the apex. And I was just doing what I do most of the time around the wall and that, just sort of stand there. And some people were coming up to the plaque. And a couple of Gold Star wives came up. And I'll try really hard to get through this okay. conversation, but... Okay. For whatever reason, we struck up a conversation. Probably the first time I've ever talked with Gold Star wives. I've had conversation with Gold Star mothers, but not Gold Star wives.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one gal in the group that it was three women. Two of them were Gold Star wives. The other was just a friend. And this one gal, it was her first time.
Oh,
she'd
boy.
Never been there before. And she told the story about she was only 19 when she found out that her husband had died. And she was from a small town in Pennsylvania. I just really kind of clicked with her.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally asked what my connection was, and I explained to them. And I'm always kind of surprised that anybody thinks it was much of anything. But I explained to them what it was, and... they thought they were very interested in that. They thought that was pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said, well, you know, I have, she said, that must have been very hard. And I said, it was. And I said to her, but you have to know there was me or someone like me at the top of that ramp when they went into war. And we did it good. So I had a chance to finally tell one of the wives
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that there was someone there. So she and I both cried, by the way. So.
And I'm sure that...
That was huge for me.
And probably for her, too. Probably for her, too, Helen.
Well, I would hope so. I've always wanted to be able to let them know that they just didn't go into war without someone there that would have said goodbye like they would have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was not, I didn't expect that opportunity. That would have been my last thing that I would have ever guessed that I would have had an opportunity to talk to a Gold Star mother. She was very nice. We exchanged emails, and I hope to hear from her. So.
I'm going to take